NPR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. 50 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court said separate schools for black and white children were inherently unequal. Our guest today is Georgetown Law Professor Cheryl Cashin. She says despite the promise of the Brown decision, segregation in America continues and is on the rise. Cheryl Cashin is the author of The Failures of Integration, How Race and Class Are Undermining the American Dream. Professor Cashin says, quoting here, racial segregation is still pervasive and class segregation seems to be an accepted norm. She says, race is still a fault line in America and class separation is widely accepted as the natural order. What does this mean for our country? Well, Cheryl Cashin fears if we do not move beyond what she describes as the racial narrative that has defined social discourse in this country since its inception, we will fall far short of our potential. The costs for all will continue to climb. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon. I look forward to your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. In Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside Champaign-Urbana, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Cheryl Cashin was a law clerk to Thurgood Marshall and served in the Clinton White House as an advisor on urban and economic policy. Her book, The Failures of Integration, How Race and Class Are Undermining the American Dream, is published by Public Affairs Books. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Cashin, good afternoon. Thank you for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure.
I think it is very interesting interjecting the idea of class in this discussion that you have in the failures of integration and in a discussion of the ways in which we separate ourselves from one another. How significant is class in America today?
Well, you are much more likely in the 2000s than you would have been in 1970 to live in a neighborhood where the people around you reflect your own socioeconomic class. You know, actually, because of the civil rights movement and anti-discrimination laws, with each passing decade from 1970 forward, we have made slow, glacial improvements in racial segregation or decreasing racial segregation. I mean, they're very modest improvements, but at least we're in an improving direction. But class segregation has been on the increase since 1970, although we had a little bit of a respite during the very prosperous 90s. So class divisions, I think, are on the rise in America.
Do you think we're as conscious of class as we are of race?
When it comes to black people, frankly, I think race is still the dominant factor. I mean, even looking at social surveys and empirical data, a climb up the economic ladder for a black person does not guarantee that they will be less segregated in American society, whereas for Latinos and Asians, as they rise up the economic ladder, they're more likely to be assimilated. So I think with African Americans, race is still very, very much the dominant factor, although there's clearly class issues there, because there are, you know, still high numbers of poor blacks. But you know, you can see in the political debates, I think, particularly with the tax policies of the Bush administration, class issues I think are becoming more heightened in our political discourse. Even though we profess to abhor class divisions. And in the area that I talk about where class comes in mostly in my book is about our neighborhoods and how they are ordered. I think a lot of people accept as natural the idea that neighborhoods should be, you know, people who can afford a $100,000 house should live in a certain neighborhood, and people who can afford a $500,000 house should live in another neighborhood. And I try to point out that our neighborhoods, our separated neighborhoods, are a result of conscious public policy choices. Our neighborhoods actually were rather mixed in terms of income and class at the dawn of the 20th century, and actually rather mixed racially. But it's been through conscious public policy choices that we are pushing people who are different apart, and I think that's dangerous for American democracy.
Yeah. This, you say, what we've got is a system of winners and losers, and mm-hmm. and that is becoming ever more so the case.
Yeah, I say we're rapidly moving toward a winner take all society if we're not already there. I mean, our public policies tend to create communities of intense abundance and communities of intense need, and in a society that sets up winner and loser communities and winner and loser schools, and often even winner and loser tracks within schools, everybody has to scratch and claw to try to be sure that they and their kids get and stay in the winner column. What I'm arguing in this book is really, in my view, only the people who can afford to buy their way into what I call the gold standard neighborhoods, and it's only about 7% of the metropolitan population will live in what I call these favored communities that have they're overwhelmingly white and virtually poverty-free, and they tend to have the best of everything and the worst of nothing, except perhaps traffic. They're near where most of the job growth is going on, where most of the private investment in stores and retail and amenities that you would like near your home are, and they have high, they had high quality schools. Well, anybody who can't afford to get in that kind of gold standard neighborhood, which includes a lot of average middle class white people, gets a very different deal in America. And I'm arguing that if our public policies were aimed to steer us in a more inclusive direction, where we were consciously trying to cultivate racially and economically mixed neighborhoods, there would be more choices for everyone. There'd be, you know, more affordable, stable neighborhoods with a healthy balance of different types of people, not neighborhoods that are overwhelmed by poverty, and you'd have more opportunity for everyone.
Hmm. But at the same time, when you say American dream, you know, people think of that gold standard home and that safe neighborhood with an excellent school down the street.
Oh, absolutely. I think that it has been, culturally, it seems to be what people strive for. But I try to offer alternative ways of thinking about this, and I offer up families in the book who have chosen a different course. I feature, for example, one family, a white couple with five children, who live in the District of Columbia, a majority black city, and chose rather than to spend almost as much of their disposable income as possible in order to get into the majority white part of the city, they chose to situate themselves in a middle class, predominantly black community where the housing prices are a fraction of what they would be in the majority white communities. And they're quite happy, and because they made that choice, the woman of the couple is able to not work and be very, very involved in her children's lives and very, very involved in a lot of community and public education projects that are important to her. And she has all five of her kids in public schools, They happen to be schools where their kids are in the minority, but they're doing quite well. And so, and that's a different dream. It's an affordable dream and possibly a saner dream than some of these extremely overpriced neighborhoods are. We actually have a run-up in bankruptcies in this country. There's a book, I hate to plug somebody else's book, but it's a good book. It's called The Two-Income Trap, by Elizabeth Warren and her daughter, a Harvard law professor. But she shows how there's been a run-up in bankruptcies in this country with two-parent middle-class families because they feel so much pressure to buy their way into these very expensive neighborhoods. And if one parent loses a job, everything falls apart. So while, yes, there is this mythic American dream, I'm arguing that very few people are really achieving that. And, for the person who can't afford the overwhelmingly white, super expensive neighborhood, a lot of people are going further and further out in the suburban fringe, and they endure heavy costs of this lifestyle choice. Anywhere from 1 to 3 hours a day in the car, an existence where they have to drive for every human function. And one of the most ironic statistics I came across was that suburbanites are at a higher risk of death due to accidents than city dwellers, even with the higher rates of crime in the city because people spend so much time in the car. So, I try to debunk certain myths about America, and I think this mythological American dream is one that fewer people are achieving than you might imagine.
Hmm. I want to go back to this family in D.C. that you talked about.
Mm-hmm.
People who you would term ardent integrationists.
Mm-hmm.
Karen.
Right.
What made her become an ardent integrationist? What led her to that path?
Well, actually, I think I her name I gave was Catherine, but
oh,
not her real name.
Sorry.
It's the name we decided we would
okay.
give her. she actually had led an integrated life. It's not surprising. She called herself a CIA brat, and like people who grew up in the military, I think she led a fairly integrated life as a child, so she was predisposed toward that. And I think she also grew up in a family that had a lot of activism in terms of during the civil rights era. So I think she was predisposed to think that way. But I also feature what I call ambivalent integrationists,
mm-hmm.
people who stumble on it. I feature a number of women who live in South Arlington, which is a county, a suburb of Washington, D.C., and they all have their kids in public school, in schools where black and Latinos form the majority. And because the quality of the schools is quite good, they've decided to stay. A number of them didn't necessarily choose, like their actual neighborhood isn't necessarily all that diverse, but because of a mixture of housing patterns, there are, there's an interesting socioeconomic mix in the schools. And, some of them struggle with the challenges of it, but they decided to stay. And they're kind of making up things as they go along in terms of the challenges of managing diversity. But many of these women remark at how very different their children's worldview is because of growing up in a highly diverse milieu, one where they see a lot of kids who aren't living privileged lives and as a result really appreciate their own privilege. And they live very diverse lives. Their kids have friends from all walks of life and all colors. And, my hope is that if we can cultivate more communities and institutions that give people that kind of opportunity in a way that's viable, we can begin to cultivate more, comfort with difference as we become a very diverse nation.
Hmm. Cheryl Cashin is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. She's a professor of law at Georgetown. She's the author of The Failures of Integration, How Race and Class Are Undermining the American Dream. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, Join the discussion with a telephone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a listener waiting to talk with us in Champaign on line one. Go ahead.
Hello, Professor Cashin.
Hello.
I'm calling, and of course, when I heard you clerk for Justice Thurgood Marshall, I almost had a conniption because he's one of my idols, and I still enjoy the book Juan Williams wrote, the biography, Thurgood Marshall, American Revolutionary.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that had to be a heady experience for you.
It was far and away the best year of my life.
Yeah, he's a great man. And I'm calling because I grew up in a southern, rural southern state, in the southern part of that state, as an African-American doing Jim Crow. In a African-American ghetto. But it was a strange dynamic because at that time in the South, people of African Americans of all classes tended to live together.
Right.
And so you had dentists, a few dentists, and doctors, lawyers, a few lawyers, as well as, in my father's case, a common laborer, all living in the same neighborhood, going to the same churches, participating in the same Masonic lodges, et cetera, et cetera. So class was not a big issue there. Race, as you know, was the fundamental issue in Jim Crow South. As I have climbed the ladder of the American dream, if you will, recently retiring from faculty full professorship at the University of Illinois College of Law, I now notice that even in the black community, among my colleagues of all disciplines at the University of Illinois, class has become an issue, at least in terms of how we live and where we live. And that, I think, predominates a number of cities that once black people become realizers of the American dream, they tend to move out of those neighborhoods that they once lived in, leaving them sort of in a destitute position and therefore exacerbating the socioeconomic ills of African Americans who might compose, for lack of a better word, the underclass.
Right, right.
So class has become more pronounced in American society, even within the African-American society. I'd like your comment on that.
Absolutely. I mean, you've hit upon a critical issue. I have a chapter. By the way, I was born and raised in Huntsville, Alabama. I'm a fellow Southerner.
You're a fellow Southerner, then.
I have a chapter in the book called The Black Middle Class Dilemma, and it deals with this rising class schism in the black community. You know, there is a lot of nostalgia on the part of black people for the pre-civil rights black community that, you know, many people, including yourself, talk about. Part of the reason why these communities were so eminently viable is precisely because they were socioeconomically integrated. And as you say, you know, blacks of all walks of life participated in the same institutions. They went to the same schools, same churches, same community organizations. Now, the genie is out of the bottle. You know, it's not surprising that when we finally got fair housing laws on the books, and really wasn't until the late 80s that we got fair housing laws with teeth on the books, but it's not surprising that those with more economic means would be the first people to take advantage of opportunities to move elsewhere. And what I say to people who are integration weary, and who a lot of black people are, I mean, this is a brutally honest book, and I talk about that.
I'm integration weary.
You are?
I'm one of those African Americans.
Yeah, yeah. There are a lot of people who feel that way. And I say two things. One, I did adopt Justice Marshall's integrationist religion. It is a pro-integration book.
Right.
But class mixing is a form of integration. And even for those black people who are integration weary, I say that for those people who long for and want to live in a black community, you need to check your classism. And I feature the highest income majority black jurisdiction in the country, Prince George's County, a suburb of Washington, D.C., that has enormous, tremendous black wealth. And I underscore why this community is having some difficulties. They haven't a lot of the people with means are bypassing the public institutions. They're not sending their kids to public school. They're not supporting the public schools with their votes for more funding. And I say that, you know, try as you might as an upper-income black person or even a middle-class black person, you're not going to be able to escape your lower-income brethren unless you're willing to be an integration pioneer and move to an overwhelmingly white community. So that is the black middle-class dilemma. And so within black communities, I think we need to be cultivating institutions that are dedicated to bringing all kids along, including and most importantly the low-income kids among us. So, yes, I can only just say that I concur in your observations that class divisions are emerging and becoming more intense in the black community, and it is a fundamental barrier to the long-term, I guess, well-being of black people.
I agree wholeheartedly. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your call.
Thanks for the call. Others are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest this afternoon, Cheryl Cashin, author of The Failures of Integration, How Race and Class Are Undermining the American Dream. Talk with us now, if you would, about the importance of integration, class and racial, for children. What does segregation cost our children?
Yes. Well, let me give your listeners a brief update on where we are in public schools.
Okay.
Because our schools are more segregated than our neighborhoods. The average existence for a black or Latino child in public school in America today is one where a majority of their peers are a minority and at least half of their peers are poor. And in elementary schools, the average is more like two-thirds. So lots of black and brown kids are learning in very highly impoverished environments. The average experience for a white child in public school is exactly the opposite, one where a majority of their peers are white and middle class. And so it's not surprising that you have an achievement gap between whites and blacks and Latinos, because the number one indicator of a school's likely performance is the socioeconomic background of the kids. It is truly challenging to educate children well in a highly impoverished environment. You're fighting a culture that often denigrates learning. A lot of poor kids together often don't have a host of involved parents. You often have less experienced teachers and less resources. So that's where we are today. Now, And much of this divide has to do with an urban-suburban divide. You know, majority of whites live in suburbs and the majority of blacks live in the urban core, and a lot of immigrants live in the urban core. So, how can integration make a difference? Despite how difficult it is, you know, there are studies that show that if you take a kid out of a highly impoverished environment, no matter what their race, and put them in a middle-class environment, they do better. You know, there's no question that they do better. They tend to rise to the expectations that are given them, and they see better behavior, and they see and they're in a culture of achievement, and they do better. And I point this out in my chapter on education. I point out these studies to show that, you know, every state in the union has been fighting a battle about funding in schools and the challenge of equalizing funding in schools, because we have tax wealthy districts and tax poor different districts that tend to divide along lines of race and class. And there's a lot of research, you know, and evidence. So despite 30 years of Title I federal funding for disadvantaged schools and trying to put extra resources into highly impoverished minority schools, we really aren't doing that well. And I'm arguing that unless and until we face the really hard issues about how we cultivate schools that aren't overwhelmed by poverty, where you have class mixing, if you can't, and hopefully race mixing, I don't think we're going to be able to live up to our ideals of providing all, bringing all kids along. And this is why so much of my book focuses on housing, because I think it'll be very difficult to cultivate mixed race schools and mixed class and mixed race schools if we don't cultivate mixed class and mixed race neighborhoods.
Hmm. If you ask people if attacking poverty is something we should do, I suspect an overwhelming majority would say yes. If you ask people if we should bring all children along, I imagine an overwhelming majority would say yes. But you know, here in Illinois, we've got this issue in terms of making the playing field fairer, more level for kids in various school districts. Some mm-hmm. districts are so wealthy, others are much poorer.
Right.
And if you, when you start to have that discussion, some people think you're taking something from me. How do you negotiate that?
Well, I try to offer in the last chapter of the book, which is entitled What to Do About It, mm-hmm. I try to offer examples of grassroots coalitions across boundaries of race and class, people who got together and brought together a lot of stakeholders from a variety of backgrounds to change a public policy choice, be it in the housing context or the schools context or you know, something as simple as getting better and fairer bus routes for any inner city people who don't have cars so they could get out to the suburbs. And what I'm saying is to do anything remotely progressive in this country, we are going to have to return to coalition building. Sustain coalition building across boundaries of race and class. And so what I try to do in this book, you know, I don't pretend that I will ever be able to convince everyone in American society, particularly the person who is most advantaged by race and class segregation. And they may not, you know, they may not appreciate me saying that, but people who have the privilege of living in overwhelmingly white, poverty-free neighborhoods are advantaged by race and class segregation because their homogeneity creates, you know, the absence of low-income people in their environment creates the concentration of it elsewhere. So they are advantaged by it, but no one gives up advantage easily. You know, my hero Frederick Douglass says, power concedes nothing without a demand. So I try to offer examples of grassroots coalitions that got together to recapture majoritarian politics to make saner public policy choices. I could give you a quick example, although I don't know if you want to interject at this point.
Go ahead.
Okay.
One
of my favorite examples is the Twin Cities area. In the Twin Cities area of Minnesota, Minneapolis and St. Paul, the representatives of the central cities and the first ring of older declining suburbs, which were represented, where a lot of blue-collar, white ethnic groups lived, they figured out that their representatives formed a majority in the state legislature. And a coalition was formed among these inner-city groups, included, you know, African-American churches, inner-city advocates, and blue-collar, white ethnic people. And, you know, Jesse Ventura, who was a mayor of one of these declining suburbs at the time, and, you know, he helped be part of this coalition, you know, when they realized that a lot of the public policy choices were disproportionately advantaging high-income, high-growth suburbs who were receiving more than their fair share of infrastructure dollars, more than their fair share of private investment. So they were able to get through a series of very progressive pieces of legislation through this coalition, including tax-based sharing, a fair share affordable housing bill that forced these suburbs to open up and have some affordable housing, a metropolitan council that had veto power over some land use decisions. So this is just an example. So I wouldn't begin, I'm just being brutally honest, I would not begin a negotiation with the most advantaged person in my metropolitan area or in American society. I would begin a negotiation with people or constituents who are harmed by current public policies, and try to show them in very clear, data-driven ways the way in which X, Y, or Z policy harms them. Because you have to speak to people's self-interest. Mm. But I would argue that even the most privileged person in American society is harmed by an America that's premised on separatism. You know, we are rapidly moving toward the day when, and this will happen shortly after mid-century, America is going to be a majority-minority nation, like California and Hawaii are today. And yet we're not prepared for that beautifully diverse future, that the children in public school today are going to be the workers of tomorrow. And if we don't figure out a way to cultivate all Americans and all their talents, we are not going to be competitive, and we're not going to live up to our ideals. So, I say to the privileged person in American society, what will they get from a society that's trying to become more integrated, more inclusive, rather than exclusionary? The willing privileged integrationist, and by the way, there's more demand for stable, racially integrated neighborhoods than there are neighborhoods to fill that demand. But the willing privileged integrationists will be able to live in a diverse society without fear and be able to more confidently participate in America's public institutions. If we have more schools that aren't overwhelmed by poverty, you might feel like, oh, I might have more money for retirement if I don't have to pay for private school, and I might have more money for retirement if I don't have to pay this exorbitant price for a house, and can confidently move to this neighborhood over here that's actually more diverse and more interesting. And meanwhile, the more marginalized person, the low-income person, will have more access to the levers of upward mobility. And that's the alternative vision I try to offer in this book.
Yeah. Well, I think it's something that we see in those people you identify as accidental integrationists, is mm-hmm. that they have come to see that individual welfare depends on collective welfare.
Right. Right. And, you know, I couldn't have said it better. What I worry about for America is that in with growing diversity and this very separated architecture of America, that a lot of people, I think, in their daily lives don't feel like they even have the luxury of thinking about other people's children or thinking about the collective. You know, I just think that people feel so much daily anxiety, they're just trying to get through the day and to be sure that they and their kids are doing okay. And I'm arguing there wouldn't be so much daily anxiety in the lives of Americans in a more inclusive society where more neighborhoods and schools and institutions work for everybody.
Our guest today here on the Afternoon Magazine, Georgetown Law Professor Cheryl Cashin, author of The Failures of Integration, How Race and Class Are Undermining the American Dream. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. I look forward to your questions and comments. We've got about 10 minutes left in this portion of the program. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Early in the book, Professor, you make this observation: in my experience on the East Coast, a truly integrated social gathering outside of work or a professional event is rare enough that one notices when it happens. This has a couple of things that are very interesting. One of them, I think, is that in the workplace, perhaps the workplace is our least segregated space.
Yeah.
And what can we learn from? What can we build on from that? What can we take from this space where we all spend so much time, the workplace?
Well, I guess in one sense we should celebrate the victories of the civil rights movement. Although we could always do better, and don't deny that we could do better, it's a good thing that our anti-discrimination laws have helped, and our affirmative policies have helped to create a more diverse workplace where you can experience diversity in that setting. I just want to pause to celebrate that as a victory. What is the take-home message of the fact that people experience diversity in the world of work, or at least some people, a lot of people do, and then return home at the end of the day to a very homogeneous private space? It says to me that there's a lot of the source to me of a lot of racial tension. It is the lack of fora or places where people experience each other and just sit down and talk about things, work on things together. I think that's what part of what contributes to social tension is there's a lot of physical distance, and we don't have a lot of experience dealing with the other in an intimate way. And I think that's unfortunate, because I think if you did have the experience of working on a multiracial project, and I find this, and anybody who grew up in the military, if you talk to them, very long, you realize what a very different world view they have than a lot of the rest of us, because it was a thoroughly integrated institution, and they have this experience of a common enterprise where they're working towards something. And you sometimes experience this with people who played sports, team sports a lot, and they had experience of working with people who were different on a common enterprise. People tend to develop what I call more cultural dexterity. And this is what everybody of all races is going to need in a very diverse society, the ability to walk into a setting or a situation where you might be completely outnumbered by a different group or a lot of different types of people, and experience that not with fear, like the fright or flight reaction, but the, hey, this is cool. This is an interesting experience. And in a very segregated America where we're not living among each other very much, there's less opportunity to do that.
Let's talk with another listener, caller on campus on line one. Good afternoon.
Oh, hello. I haven't heard all of the interview, so maybe you touched on this, but, I wonder if overnight we could integrate all the schools in the country and equalize how much money that they have to spend across the whole United States. I wonder if things would really significantly change. And my reason for saying that is that there are a lot of it's clear that there certainly is a correlation with poor school performance, with racial segregation, and with a lack of resources. But there are probably a lot of other things that are contributing. With regard to lack of resources, I remember reading recently that the schools in Washington, D.C. spend an incredible amount of money per student, probably something like $13,000 per student, way more than a school district maybe in rural Illinois. And yet the results in Washington, D.C. are absolutely atrocious. So the money is not necessarily a determining factor of the outcome. And there's also a correlation with when you have a poor school district and a lot of racial segregation, students are coming from families that are not the two-parent families that are in typical white suburban ones, and there may be a parent who can help with homework and who reads to the kids and so on, and that may not be the case. So I'm not so sure that even if we change things overnight that it would make a difference.
Okay, I agree with you on the funding point, and I did talk about this earlier. I think if I had a choice between throwing a lot more money at a large urban school system with a bunch of poor kids and an alternative which would guarantee that every kid, every poor kid is guaranteed to be in a school where at least half of the rest of the kids were middle class, I would take the latter. This is a brutally honest book. There are no sacred cows for me, and I am the first person who's willing to admit that in a high poverty environment, you have a lot of cultural issues that make it very hard to educate children well. And one of the big ones is in a highly impoverished culture, there tends to be an oppositional culture that denigrates learning, you know, precisely because you have a lot of kids coming from families with very stressful situations and learning is not the, you know, something that's truly valued. So, you know, one of the innovations that I applaud in the book is they're about two dozen school districts that have picked up where Brown left off and are focusing on class integration and trying to assign kids in a way where no kids are overwhelmed by poverty. And there is there's social science empirical data which does show that poor kids just do better in middle class settings and without any change in money. And so I applaud anything that helps do that, you know, the choice movement, the charter schools movement. I even make an argument, and this is not my idea, I saw it somewhere else. What about universal choice? Why should somebody be their ability to get into a very good school be limited by their ability to buy their way in their neighborhood? And so some people have proposed that school assignments should be on a lottery system, and somebody who lives in the inner city, if they wanted to take the effort to travel across jurisdictions to a suburban high school, they ought to be able to do that within their own state. So I agree with you that money is not the only issue. I think cultivating race and class integration will help, particularly class integration for the reasons I mentioned.
I know that with regard to your point about there needs to be a culture that really appreciates that. That was, I think, the point that Bill Cosby was making just a few weeks ago, and he got a lot of unfortunate comments about what he said. But I think he hit the nail on the head.
Well, I agree with the sentiment that, and I think Barack Obama is one of the more thoughtful people on this point. I wholeheartedly agree with the sentiment that everybody should be held responsible for being a good parent, for teaching values, for just their own responsible behavior, and that the black community should not be let off the hook for things that are going on that are a problem. At the same time, I don't think it's an either or proposition. Say that we need better values and we need to assume responsibility with our own institution for teaching those values, that doesn't mean that our public policies shouldn't be trying to do things that deconcentrate poverty, for example, or make it easier for a person to work to get to live in safe, decent, affordable housing. I just don't think these are either-or propositions.
I want to thank the listener for his call, and I want to try and get one more listener in here this afternoon before we have to wrap things up, but we'll have to be quick all around. A caller in Urbana, line 2. Hi.
Hi. What is your opinion of school vouchers?
Well, I certainly understand the growing support among African-American parents for school vouchers because they are more likely to be trapped in poorly performing school, and they deserve options. That said, I believe that vouchers and the voucher debate is a distraction or sort of a red herring because almost everywhere where you have a voucher program, it's a demonstration program where vouchers are available to a relatively small subset of the entire population. So, and we would never be able to solve the problems of urban education through vouchers because it would bankrupt the system to try to maintain the public school system and give everybody a voucher. And even if they were able to afford to give every disadvantaged kid who's trapped in a bad school a voucher, there's not enough places to absorb all those kids. So I think the voucher debate is a distraction from the harder work that we just have to face. How are we going to cultivate a public school system that gives quality education to every child? And I just don't think that we are going to get there solely through a voucher system.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon, and there we'll leave it. We're out of time. Cheryl Cashin, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you so much, and thanks to your listeners.
Cheryl Cashin is a professor of law at Georgetown University. She's the author of The Failures of Integration, How Race and Class Are Undermining the American Dream. The Failures of Integration, published by Public Affairs Books. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. From the Board of Trade this afternoon, futures finished the day lower after the beans did take a little trip to the higher side, but they finished down a nickel and a half in that November contract. Let's start with the wheat bit, which has had a pretty good week thus far. Did finish a little lower for the day. The nearby September was off a penny and a quarter at 327 and a quarter. Their high today, 328, low at 325 and a half. Once again, that September wheat contract finished at 327 and a quarter, down one and a quarter. Now the December contract, 336 and a half, the high, the low at 331 and a quarter. Their settlement price at 331 and three quarters, off 4.5 on the day. And the March futures in the wheat pit, 346 and a quarter, the high, the low at 341 and three quarters, settled at 342 and a half. They were off 4.25 for the day. May futures in the wheat pit, 349, the high, the low at 346 and a half, settled at 346 and three quarters, down 3.75. And July futures were off 2 cents at 347 and a quarter, with a high of 350 and a low at 346 for a 4 cent trading range. September corn now 211, the high, the low at 206 and a quarter, settled 206 and a half. They were down 3.75. December futures, 221, the high, the low at 217 and three quarters, settled 218, 2.5 lower. And the March contract, 230 for the high, low at 227, settled 227 and a quarter, down 2.25. May corn, 236, the high, the low at 233 and three quarters, settled at 234. They were off a penny and three quarters. And July futures, a 241 high, low at 238 and three quarters, settled 239, off 1.75. December corn for next year, 251 and three quarters, the high, the low at 250 and a half, settled 250 and three quarters, a quarter of a cent above the low for the day. They were off a penny. September oats now 162, the high, the low at 158, settled up on the high at 162. They were 2 cents higher. December futures at 161 for the high, the low at 156, settled 160 and three quarters, up 4.25. From the soy complex, the nearby beans were a penny lower at the end of the day, had a high today of 567. That was in the positive area, low at 559 and three quarters. They settled 560, lost a penny for the day. November beans now 575, the high, the low at 565. A settlement price at 565 and a half, down 5.5 cents. And the January contract, 582, the high, the low at 572 and a half, settled 573, down 6. March soybeans, 589, the high, the low at 579, settled 579 and a quarter, down 6 and three quarters. And the May futures, 593, the high, the low at 584 and a half, settled 585 and a quarter, down 5 and three quarters. July soybeans, 599, the high, the low at 590, settled 590 and a quarter, down 4 and three quarters for the day. From the bean meal pit, September contract, 173.50, the high, low at 166, settled on that low, down 620, and the October contract was off 140 in the bean meal pit, at 167.80 for the high, 164.70 for the low, and a 165 settlement price there. Once again, that October bean meal off 140 for the day. September bean oil, 24.35, the high, the low at 23.20, a settlement price at 23.20. They were down 109, and the October contract, 23.73, the high, the low at 22.85, a settlement price at 22.95, and they were off 56 for the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Celeste?
Thank you, Todd. A mostly higher day today on the Merc for livestock prices. September feeder cattle, 113.80, the high 113.05, the low 113.55, the settlement that up 55. October, 112.10 the high, 111.10 the low, 111.40 the settlement, that down 25. November, 110.60 the high, 109.70 the low, 110.20 the settlement, that down 12.5. October live cattle, 86.05 the high, 85.25 the low, 85.42.5 the settlement, that up 40. December, 89 even the high, 88.30 the low, 88.65 the settlement, that up 22.5. October lean hogs, 67.87.5. Today's high, the low 67.35, the settlement 67.70, up 62.5. December 65.67.5, the high 64.95, the low 65.47.5, the settlement that up 52.5. February lean hog 64.65, the high 64.05, the low 64.55, the settlement that up 30. April 62.35, the high 61.85, the low, finishing at 62.35, up 37.5. And February pork bellies, today's high 95.15, the low 93.70, the settlement 94.77.5, that up 125. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 5 points at 10,320. The NASDAQ up 1 at 1911. The S&P 500 up 2 at 1128.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Illinois Farm Bureau, whose mission is to improve the economic well-being of agriculture and enrich the quality of farm family life.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Tom Craig from Asheville, North Carolina writes, Dear Dr. Science, I've heard that common house dust comes in large part from dead human skin cells. If this is so, why are abandoned houses so dusty?
Well, it turns out that ghosts shed their skin even faster than living creatures do. Most abandoned houses are haunted because most people die with unresolved issues, like trying to find their wallet or their car keys, as well as that missing W-2 and Uncle Bernie's phone number. So as long as people can't get their acts together while they're still alive, abandoned houses will continue to gather dust.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. For information about the new Dr. Science Get Smart Kit, including his new compact disc with screensaver for PCs and an honorary master's degree mouse pad, all for $21.95, call 800-989-DUCK or visit us on the web at www.drscience.com.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department now offers boxed lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Strawberry Fields, 328-1655.
You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Jason Croft is our technical director this afternoon, the producer for the Afternoon Magazine, Harriet Williamson. Let's take a look now at Ed Kieser's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon. In the north, partly to mostly sunny. In central and southern sections, look for a mix of clouds and sunshine with a few scattered showers and thunderstorms, highs between 83 and 88. Tonight, partly to mostly cloudy and mild with a few widely scattered showers during the evening hours, lows ranging between 63 and 68. Tomorrow, in the north and in central Illinois, partly sunny with scattered showers and thunderstorms arriving. Elsewhere, partly to mostly sunny and warm, highs ranging from 80 in northwestern Illinois to 88.